I am Valentin Fuster for Jack, issue of January the 21st of 2020. The Jack State of the Art review is entitled Peripartum Cardiomyopathy. The first and corresponding author is Dr. Melinda Davis from the Department of Internal Medicine, Division of Cardiovascular Medicine and Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. The last author is Dr. Uri Elkayam from the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine and Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Other authors are Dr. Salt Arani, Dr. Dennis McNamara, and Dr. Sorel Goland. I am addressing this interesting and very up-to-date paper in 8 different sections. Section number 1, an introduction and summary. Section number 2, definition, epidemiology, and risk factors. Section number 3, pathophysiology. Section number 4, diagnosis. Section number 5, prognosis and outcomes. Section number 6, management. Section number 7, prior to hospital discharge. And section number 8, subsequent pregnancy. Let's begin with section number 1, introduction and summary. We try it to outline 10 important points. Point number 1, peripartum cardiomyopathy is a form of systolic heart failure with reduced left ventricular ejection fraction affecting childbearing women during late pregnancy or in the early postpartum period. Point number 2, symptoms of heart failure mimic those of normal pregnancy, often resulting in a delay in diagnosis and preventable complications. Point number 3, the incidence of peripartum cardiomyopathy vary by regions. For example, a high incidence of 1 in 100 deliveries occurs in Nigeria, while in the United States, the incidence varies between 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 4,000. Point number 4. In regard to pathophysiology, based in 2 mouse models and epidemiological data, support the notion that peripartum cardiomyopathy is in large part a microvascular disease triggered by the hormonal milieu of the peripartum. We are talking about an increased level of prolactin, which may be vasculotoxic and proapoptotic, secreted hormone that can be counteracted by bromocriptin. But furthermore, there is a frequent interaction with a genetic variant of the TTN, with other contributors including preeclampsia or hypertension, older maternal age, and in terms of ethnicity, African-American. Point number 5. In terms of diagnosis, echocardiography showing decreased myocardial function is essential, with a left ventricular ejection fraction considered to be less than 45%. Point number 6. What about prognostic factors? The most important one appears to be a left ventricular ejection fraction of less than 30% at the time of diagnosis. In addition, from the functional point of view, high troponin or high NT-proBNP are also prognostic. And so, the placental secretion of the so-called soluble FMS-like tyrosine kinase 1 or SFLT1, which is an antagonist of vascular endothelial growth factor. In addition, in terms of prognostic factors, are also important to consider some of the etiological factors that we mentioned a minute ago: concomitant preeclampsia, African-American ethnicity, and older maternal age. Point number 7. Medical management is similar to heart failure with reduced ejection fraction of other etiologies. But importantly, adjustments during pregnancy are necessary to ensure fetal safety. For example, usual medications for the treatment of heart failure may have bad fetal consequences. For example, ACE inhibitors and receptor blockers, aldosterone receptor antagonists, ARNI, and ibabradine. On the other hand, loop diuretics and beta blockers, except atenolol, appear to be appropriate for the treatment of peripartum cardiomyopathy when the diagnosis is made during the time of pregnancy or at the end of pregnancy. Point number 8. The outcomes are variable. In the United States, over a period of 1 year, about 50% to 75% of the patients recover ventricular function. However, in some patients, there is persistent heart failure, arrhythmias, thromboembolic events, and even mortality. Point number 9. Subsequent pregnancy, particularly in those patients who have not recovered ventricular function, are prone to a substantial risk of relapse. And still there is some risk in those who fully recover ventricular function during the episode of peripartum cardiomyopathy. And point number 10, long-term follow-up is important, but the optimal duration of medication following recovery is actually unknown. Furthermore, we should ensure a stability of left ventricular function after at least 3 months off of these medications prior to considering that the left ventricle is fully recovered. After this section of introduction and summary, let's now address several details. So here we have section number 2, definition, epidemiology, and general risk factors. Peripartum cardiomyopathy has been defined by the European Society of Cardiology as an idiopathic cardiomyopathy presenting with heart failure secondary to left ventricular systolic dysfunction towards the end of pregnancy or in the months following delivery, where no other cause of heart failure is found. The diagnostic criteria should indicate a left ventricular ejection fraction of less than 45%. In terms of epidemiology, this varies by regions, with the disease taking place in about 1 in 100 deliveries in Nigeria, in 1 in 300 deliveries in Haiti, as low as 1 in 20,000 deliveries in Japan, and in the United States is about 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 4,000 deliveries. What about conventional risk factors? African ancestry is important. In fact, in the United States, more than 40% of the cases occur in African American women. Clinical or environmental contributors are preeclampsia and hypertension, multigestational pregnancies, older maternal age, since peripartum cardiomyopathy in about half of the cases occur in women over the age of 30, and a minority of women with peripartum cardiomyopathy have a family history of cardiomyopathy. And this leads to section number 3, pathophysiology. The etiology of peripartum cardiomyopathy appears to be multifactorial. For some time it has been considered that nutritional deficiencies, viral myocarditis, and autoimmune processes play a role. But more recent information is interesting. First of all, two animal models have suggested that the secretion of the hormone prolactin towards the end of pregnancy may play a role by a vasculotoxic and pro-apoptotic properties. In a suppressor of prolactin secretion, bromocriptine, can induce complete reversal in such animal models. It is interesting that the vasculotoxic effect by prolactin may be related to its decrease in expression of vascular endothelial growth factor. In this context, it is also worth mentioning that vascular endothelial growth factor may be antagonized by the placental secretion of SFLT1, an enzyme with significant high levels in women with preeclampsia. But also of interest, in a number of such patients, a genetic background has been observed, specifically truncating variants of the TTN gene. So, as we said at the beginning of this section, the etiology of peripartum cardiomyopathy is likely multifactorial. And this leads to section number 4, diagnosis. 3 aspects: timing and clinical presentation, diagnostic testing, and differential diagnosis. In terms of timing and clinical presentation, the majority of women with peripartum cardiomyopathy are diagnosed after delivery, typically in the first month postpartum. The problem is that probably it has been unrecognized towards the end of pregnancy. So the symptomatology and physical examination have not addressed such possibility. A minority of patients will present with cardiogenic shock, severe arrhythmias, and thromboembolic complications. What about diagnostic testing? Echocardiography should be performed in any suspected case. Although we talk about a left ventricular ejection fraction typically to be less than 45% to define the syndrome, other aspects may be dilatation of the left ventricle, right ventricular dysfunction, some functional mitral and tricuspid regurgitation, and biatrial enlargement, and not forgetting the possibility of intracardiac thrombus at the apex. While BNP and N-terminal pro-BNP do not change significantly during normal pregnancy, they may be mildly elevated in the setting of preeclampsia and in patients with peripartum cardiomyopathy. The electrocardiogram can be normal or may show non-specific abnormalities, while the chest X-rays may show pulmonary venous congestion. Magnetic resonance imaging may provide accurate ejection fraction and chamber measurements, but we should avoid gadolinium, at least during pregnancy. Endomyocardial biopsy is only indicated if there is suspicion for an alternative diagnosis, such as giant cell myocarditis. What about the differential diagnosis? Just to say that the diagnosis of peripartum cardiomyopathy is made by exclusion. In other words, other types of cardiac disease might be considered, and so the appropriate diagnostic tools to be used. And now we have section number 5, prognosis and outcomes, a very important section. Let's discuss adverse outcomes, prognostic factors, and recovery. In terms of adverse outcomes, in about half of the patients, the symptomatology and clinical presentation may be of moderate degree. In about 25% of the cases, the clinical manifestations are more significant, while in the remaining 25%, the clinical manifestations may be somewhat severe, such as pulmonary edema, thromboembolic complications, cardiopulmonary arrest, arrhythmias, or even cardiogenic shock. Left ventricular thrombus has been identified in as much as 10 to 17% of initial echocardiograms, with thromboembolic events occurring in about 5 to 10% of the patients. Why? the hypercoagulable state of pregnancy. And here what is added is cardiac dilatation and dysfunction, venous stasis, and bed rest. Not mentioning postoperative status after cesarean section, which should be avoided. So in this section of prognosis and outcomes, there is a second aspect, prognostic factors. Basically are the same risk factors that we mentioned before, the most important one being a significantly low left ventricular ejection fraction, for example of less than 30%, African-American ethnicity, concomitant preeclampsia, older maternal age, and elevated levels of troponin and NT-proBNP, as well as high levels of SFLT1. Nothing new, we already mentioned such risk factors as part of playing a role in the etiology of the disease and here in the prognosis. Just mention that in terms of outcomes and prognosis, the overall mortality at 1 year of follow-up in the United States has been about 4%, being over 10% in the African-American women. So in this section of prognosis and outcomes, we talk about adverse outcomes, risk factors. But what about when things are good? That is recovery. Frequently occurs within the first 3 to 6 months, but maybe up to 2 years. Good news in about 50% to 75% of peripartum cardiomyopathy in the United States. Again, the recovery being significantly less in African American women. And this leads to section number 6, management. We'll talk about medical management, specifically about anticoagulation, then about the experimental treatment with bromocriptin, also about the treatment of severe peripartum cardiomyopathy, and finally what to do with labor and delivery. About medical management, following delivery, most heart failure medications are compatible with breastfeeding and should be used. On the other hand, during pregnancy, a number of heart failure medications should be avoided because of fetal possible adverse effects. We are talking about ACE inhibitors and receptor blockers, aldosterone receptor antagonist, sacubitril valsartan, ibavardin, and among the beta blockers, atenolol or denormin. They should be avoided. What about the specific aspect of anticoagulation? There is agreement that anticoagulation should be considered in the setting of severely decreased left ventricular ejection fraction, less than 30 to 35%, this during the late pregnancy and at 6 to 8 weeks postpartum. Just remember, warfarin crosses the placenta and is avoided during early pregnancy. But since peripartum cardiomyopathy occurs in late pregnancy, at that stage, better to use low molecular weight heparin since it does not cross the placenta. And warfarin and low molecular weight heparin both being safe with lactation. About the new oral anticoagulants, there is very little information, although some case reports may suggest to avoid such new drugs during pregnancy. The third item of this section number 6, management, is the experimental treatment with bromocriptin. Bromocriptin is a dopamine agonist and inhibits the release of prolactin. And as mentioned, prolactin may be a key element in the development of peripartum cardiomyopathy. Based in 3 relatively small studies, 2 African studies and a German study, the use of bromocriptin at a dose of 2.5 milligrams twice daily for a few weeks appear to have favorable outcomes, even with no contraindication for breastfeeding, as we will see in a moment. The Rebirth study of 200 women in the United States and Canada has been proposed to better understand the role of this drug in peripartum cardiomyopathy during pregnancy and after delivery. A fourth item on this section of management is the treatment of severe peripartum cardiomyopathy. Indeed, in the setting of acute decompensated heart failure during pregnancy, intravenous vasodilator, such as nitroglycerin, not nitroprusside, and the use of the inotrope milrinone rather than levosimendan, both agents should be considered. Furthermore, in such advanced situations, mechanical circulatory support, left ventricular assist device, or even cardiac transplantation, the three of such advanced therapies have already a track record. In fact, just to mention that a total of 60% of cases of cardiogenic shock during or shortly after pregnancy are caused by peripartum cardiomyopathy. And here is the fifth and final item about management: how to approach labor and delivery. Five practical steps to be considered. First, the need of a cardio-obstetrics team of experts to address such periods of labor and delivery. Second, unless proven otherwise, vaginal delivery should be the indication of choice, since cesarean delivery is associated with a higher incidence of hemorrhage, infection, and thromboembolic complications. Third, hemodynamic instability despite medical therapy should prompt early delivery. Fourth, unstable patients may benefit from invasive hemodynamic optimization prior to delivery, as well as monitoring during delivery and the early postpartum period. Finally, useful point number five, the postpartum risk of fluid overload and pulmonary edema must be anticipated. Why? Because following delivery, removal of cable compression by the fetus, autotransfusion due to uterine contractions, and fluid mobilization and reabsorption contribute to an increase in venous return. Well, following this section number six of management, we now have section number seven. What is the approach prior to hospital discharge? Four items: lactation, sudden death prevention, contraception, and duration of treatment. Unless there are extenuating circumstances, in terms of lactation, breastfeeding is fully indicated. So, most heart failure medications can be given safely, and although there have been some questions about the effects of prolactin secretion or the use of bromocriptine, the most recent literature continues to emphasize breastfeeding, regardless of these two pathways of hormonal and treatment circumstances. And here is the second item of how to proceed prior to hospital discharge, and that is about sudden death prevention. Two points to be made. Premature placement of an ICD, for example, should be avoided because a large proportion of women will recover to left ventricular ejection fraction more than 35% within the first 6 months of postpartum. And second, despite conflicting data in smaller studies, and until more information becomes available, it may be reasonable to consider wearable cardioverter defibrillators for women with new onset of peripartum cardiomyopathy and severe left ventricular dysfunction as a bridge to recovery or until an implantable ICD is indicated. And here is item number 3 to consider prior to hospital discharge, and this is contraception. 3 points. First, and very important, contraception should be discussed at the time of diagnosis or prior to hospital discharge. Second, in a short term, there is an increased risk of thromboembolism just related to the cardiomyopathy by itself, and therefore, if contraception is considered, a Mirena intrauterine device appears to be safe. And here is point number 3. What about long term? If subsequent pregnancy is not prevented, a recurrence of the syndrome may occur, particularly in those patients who have not recovered from left ventricular dysfunction. So contraception should be emphasized in such patients, as the long term is being addressed, or at least patients should be aware of such complication. And this leads to the final section, section number 8, subsequent pregnancy. Here the situation is that whether the myocardial function has fully recovered or not, the pre-pregnancy left ventricular ejection fraction is the strongest predictor of outcome. Let's address 3 items. When there is residual myocardial dysfunction, when the myocardial function has recovered, and about monitoring and treatment during such subsequent pregnancy. About residual myocardial dysfunction, it is fair to say that one should discourage subsequent pregnancy if the left ventricular ejection fraction is no more than 50% to 55%. After counseling such women, if they choose to proceed with pregnancy, they should be followed closely during the pregnancy. Just for the record, if there is residual myocardial dysfunction, the chances of deterioration during subsequent pregnancy is close to 50%, with mortality being about close to 15%. What about the second item? Patients that have recovered myocardial function to normality. Such patients are not free of complications during a subsequent pregnancy. About 20% of them have a substantial reduction in left ventricular ejection fraction, but mortality is rare. So preconception counseling should include discussion about the possible risks. And here is the third item, monitoring and treatment during subsequent pregnancy. 2 points. Only in women with recovered left ventricular function who are taking heart failure medications. Such medications may be discontinued, but with the assurance that left ventricular function continues to be intact at least 3 months off of these medications prior to considering that the left ventricle is fully recovered. And this is point number 2. In such patients during subsequent pregnancies, the prophylactic use of beta blockers might be considered. So this is the final statement of this interesting paper and tells us about the future of how we should advance in the understanding and management of peripartum cardiomyopathy. And I quote, "Despite many advances in our understanding of peripartum cardiomyopathy, questions remain about the pathogenesis and complex interactions of genetics with the vascular and hormonal milieu of late pregnancy. The role of bromocriptin remains unclear, and randomized clinical trials are needed for determining the risks and potential benefits. Important gaps in knowledge remain, such as the optimal anticoagulation strategy, timing of ICD implantation, risk prediction and management during a subsequent pregnancy, and the long-term duration of medications after myocardial recovery. Given the overall rarity of peripartum cardiomyopathy, collaboration among multiple centers will be needed to answer these questions. Close quotes. Thank you.